So again, thank you for inviting me, also Lucas, to organizing this here. It's an honor. Just another practical thing I forgot to say. There is also a journal laying, Forum Plus. It's an A1 for who is really interested in academic publishing. Unfortunately, it's in Dutch, but there is also an English version, so you can send also English texts on the web. And it is published by Amsterdam University Press. So it is a general thing, and it's all about research in the arts. Just because otherwise I forgot to say this, but take a look at it, and they are also for free. Anyway, I said already I was a little bit nervous to come to speak here today, but the roundup helped a little bit to make me more confident with my speech. What I will do today is bringing a kind of medley of different researchers' books we made. As I said already, I'm a sociologist of culture. I do, I think, now 25 years research in this field on several kinds. I'm very much interested always in the what I call the institutional context of the arts. So it can be about museums or policy. It can be also about the function of community art, for example, etc. Maybe I just mention the three or four researchers which are involved in my lecture and of which I make a medley, just to understand. So the first one I think is the most important for me, and I think also for you, especially when I heard your concerns. It's called The Value of Culture, and it was an assignment of a lot of art organizations in Flanders. There it started, but also the Flemish government, and they asked us find as much as possible empirical proof that culture has value. That was the assignment we get, and it was 2 months after the huge budget cuts in the Netherlands in culture field. So we were, what do we have to answer to that? So I try to give some answers I give in my lecture are based on this report. And I will mention also the title. There is an English publication on the internet. You can download it for free. It's called Culture, the Substructure of a European Common. And I mentioned this also because, maybe not for the report, but at the end of the report, you found hundreds of researchers we digged up. And we described them also with empirical proof of the value of culture. Also of social impact, social cohesion, how to measure, and discussions about that. So I think it can be very informative in a way. But I will relate this also. By the way, this is also partly, this report is published in this book, No Culture, No Europe. You can steal it there. And I jump from that to an analysis. So we really, first I will dig into what does culture do, what's the value of it, how can it have impact, etc. And then I take a step back and I will look at, but how is this used by governments, this kind of impact studies, what are we doing as researchers when we do this, and also how is a lot of social or social-artistic, we call it in Flanders, but also a lot of community art used and abused in a political sense. And from that on, I jump on to another space, and that's where the commoning art stands for. I try to look for solutions. I try to look for solutions to deal with social impact. And then for me, a very important issue comes in the political. Thinking political as a researcher also, but also thinking political as a social engaged artist, what is for me very important. So I talk about the values, but also the pitfalls of social engaged art. But first of all, and I jump now in the value of culture, this report, I want to try to define with you what culture is for me and how I define it also for the report, because culture is not only the arts. in general. So we use for this, I'm sorry, this is a little bit academic, but anyway, I use the anthropological centers of culture. So that's the way of life, as Williams defined it. But in a very specific sense, and I try to stress this enormously because it's so important, I think. I think culture, and I don't think, I know, culture is the only tool which can give meaning to our human existence, to meaning to your life, but also to meaning to your society in which you're living in. And this is, of course, not from me. Sigmund Freud mentioned this already, but also Martin Heidegger mentioned this. And his answer to the question is, why do we have culture, was in his words, Sein zum Tode. Because we are knowing we are going to die, we have culture. We invent culture. Because when you know you're going to die, you are questioning yourself, what I'm doing here. And that's the starting point of everything. And this is very important. So everything what has to do also with arts, etc., has to do with meaning making. And this is, for me, this is making sense of life. This is, for me, a very important thing. And now I go much more specific in how cultural actors, going from museums to theater companies, artists, are engaged in this cultural game to make sense. And I make a differentiation there. It's based on pedagogical, help me to explain, pedagogical research of Gert Biesta. He makes a distinction of what education does, and we translated for the report is what culture does. And he says it has three functions. And I think they are, for me, also very important or crucial for this. Just saying that culture is giving meaning means also culture is a very important tool in building society, building identities in society, giving common feelings, etc. So there are three functions, he says. One is socialization. Socialization means, I'm a sociologist, it means integrating people in a social order without questioning the social order. This is very important. So when, as a mother, you decide to give the breast or a bottle of milk, it's culture. And it's a very strong decision, and the baby cannot decide if he's in this will take the bottle or the breast. So socialization is really learning people, cultural attitudes, things what is important, etc., without questioning this order. My girlfriend works in Enter for Integration. She does this every day. She says to refugees, when you want to have a job here, when you want to integrate, you need to do this and this and this and this and this. So this is socialization. A lot of cultural actors, museums, but also education, are busy with socialization. It's a very important thing, because socialization gives you ground under your feet to stand on. You need it. It gives you the rituals, the attitudes, values, morals, ethics to live on. It gives you a routine in your daily life, orientation, compass. It's very important. Second thing is qualification. Qualification means just the thing what I do also as a professor, saying this student is better than that student. That's qualification. Making an art historical canon is qualification. It's making hierarchies. It's saying this is better than that. And even after postmodernity, we are still busy, always, certainly on the individual level, but we're doing this, qualifying things in general. So that's the second function of what actors do in culture. And the third one is, for me, most important related to the arts. It's subjectification. Subjectification is, for me, the moment when you are hit in the face. It means literally when you feel you are a subject at a certain moment. So subjectification is, for example, the moment when you are, after 10 years of a happy marriage, in a divorce. you start asking you again, what I'm doing here, what is my relationship to the world, to partners, etc. But very interesting for me, it happens also when you have a very fresh relationship of 3 months. And then asking you, who am I again in this relationship? So that's the moment of subjectification. It's really questioning yourself and your position in the social order, which was made of socialization process. So this is also what a lot of artists do. Yeah? They can do it in a very aesthetic way, just by playing with forms. They can do it in a political activist way, etc. But what a lot of artists try to do, let's say since modernity, is hitting you in the face. It is really giving you another position in it, bringing something new, just to say it blunt, where you get, you have to reposition yourself. So that's the process of subjectification. Just to end the circle, of course, you see, again, I have to stress, you need all of them. You need a hierarchy. Really, you need it. You need a value system to orientate. It can change. That's not the point. And that's the process of subjectification for. But you need hierarchy. You need socialization. But you need also subjectification to renew, to keep a culture dynamic, etc. So there's a kind of dialectics for me between subjectification and socialization. It's a kind of circle. Anyway, that was just my definition of culture. I try to go now into depth into the research and the findings of the research, the value of culture. So again, government and some artist organizations ask us, what is the value of culture? And we only want to have those researchers which really give you empirical proof of it. So we scanned whole Europe, sorry, only Europe, for studies, etc., academic journals also, and we looked for researchers which gave proof. We found five subjects or teams on which there was founded really empirical proof for the impact of arts in general, but I will only talk about two. So we found cognitive effects, experiential value, economical effects, but I will only talk about health and social effects, especially social cohesion. I thought this was a subject I took out. But before I do this, so these are all researchers which really give you die hard empirical data about the impact of certain guides. I take a step back and I question myself as a sociologist, why do I question the questions I question? And where does this question also of the value of culture comes from? And also, what is the effect of the kind of research which is done? And why is it done like this? So, my question is, what happens with value in evidence-based policy? Why am I talking about evidence-based policy? All those questions we have nowadays about impact of the arts come most of the time from governments who want to find a legitimation for their own policy. There that they come from. Also the question we get, what's the value of culture? That's a very important thing. So to legitimize ourselves, to legitimize our position, etc. And I want to just add what the effect of this is, I need a drink, of this on the research we do. The questions we can question and not can question in this relationship. So, first of all, empirical impact research is based on what I call a causality doxa. What is this? This means, for example, we talked about measurement, the whole obsession of measurement nowadays. This means, literally, that there need a moment of what I call the zero situation. Then there is something happening. For example, a theater play is playing, etc. So that's next moment. And then there is the moment of measurement again. That's causality. And we ask her the question, what is the effect, the causal effect of this theater performance, music performance, etc. So that's how we can measure in this kind of context. When you want to come up with quantified data, at least. So it's very much event based. So it is limited in time. It's very important. You can only measure it before and after. And that's something completely different than what is culture about. It's about habits, it's about conservation, for me very important of culture, etc., which is you can only measure on a very long term. That's why I was so happy. I heard somewhere longitudinal research. I think it's very important. But I'm sorry to say no politician is interested in longitudinal research. It takes too long and it's too expensive. 4 years maximum for research, also in scientific relationship. So there is already a huge problem. I think if you really want to measure the impact on a culture, you need 10, 20 years to measure, to do this research. So it's very much based on clock time, this kind of evidence-based research and policy, and it is not related to what I call embedded time, time to embed in a culture, which is the base, I think, of culture. It isolates also the effect. It is really saying, what is this reading this book doing with you, for example? So it's really isolated and based on effect. And it is decontextualizing culture. It is really taking something out of it and just looking at that. The question is, what is relevance? But what it's also do is that it is very difficult, I think, to measure an experience. An experience, especially the effect of an experience on people of art. So value becomes, in this kind of research, a function. It needs to have a function and not a value you love, you feel comfortable. So it becomes something very systemic. And the effect of this is, and it comes from a philosopher of the Netherlands, he said, what all this kind of impact studies do is, in fact, it is measuring sex only by counting the reproduction. How many kids come out? That's what we count. But of course, sex is much more than only kids or making kids. It is really about, I hope, love, intimacy. It is about feeling, also having fun also. But these are all things you can almost not measure. So that's the huge problem with all this kind of impact research. Etc. So, and another thing, this is very important, even when we question how was the sex, how do you feel with it, etc., in fact, you are not measuring real feelings. What you are measuring is the cognitive capacity to answer this question. So you are measuring cognitive capacities, not really what people feel, emotions, and what it does with you. So this is the huge problem with those interviews and surveys, etc. So it's a reduction of values to cognitive, self-reflective competences. That's what we are measuring when we are measuring impact. And that's something completely different, I think. That's so. I think it's problematic, but anyway. So to measure is not to know. To measure is to give sense, and this is very important, in a very specific way to culture. It is also a culture, measuring the impact. It is reframing the sense of culture and giving it another sense. And it's quite an ideology. I don't know if somebody knows, there are a lot of people of the UK here, where this whole idea of evidence-based research comes from. Who invented it? Yeah, but the first one who introduced it in politics.
No, I can answer.
Margaret Thatcher, healthcare. That's what she started. She started, we need to have evidence-based policy, that healthcare is. And of course it was a trick for her afterwards to privatize healthcare, in a way. So this is, so I'm very afraid of doing this kind of research and stepping in this kind of logic of governments to do this kind of research. Anyway, to go to our findings, so it's based on this kind of research, we found this kind of things were, indeed there is an impact of art. So we found a lot of empirical proof that there is an impact of art in mental and physical well-being. It's enormously. There are beautiful studies done in Ireland and in Italy, huge-scale population surveys, which measure the impact of the arts. So what we see there is, and this is for me very interesting, I think that, of course, when you go to theater or you frequently go to music concerts, etc., they measured it is helpful that you, in a mental sense, but also in a physical sense. So they really discovered that when you participate in culture, you are recovering faster. Literally, even when you have a physical health. But, of course, there's a huge, how do you say it, there is noise on this kind of way of measuring, because a lot of cultural participation is a social activity. And we know also that social relationships are almost the main healthcare thing. When you have good social relationships, they're very helpful. Interesting for this research is they measured also for cultural participation you do in isolation, reading books, novels. And even there they saw that indeed health, cultural participation, so reading books is very helpful in recovering or not getting a disease. So it's a very interesting thing. It's all reported, the details in the report, but what was amazing for us was that this cultural participation in the helping to health was the second most important determinant of well-being. So even earning a lot of money did not help. Even having a job was lower quoted than cultural participation. The only thing what was higher, I said it is the second, that was higher was if you were healthy or not. So your own physical condition. So cultural participation is really crucial in help. And it is, of course, crucial, that's something else, in developing what I call the gross national happiness product, right? Not the GDP. But the GNH or something like that. Another thing, and this is for me, I think, more important, and it's also more complex, and I have to give the credits to Hanka Otter, and you can find all her findings about social cohesion and the impact of arts in the journal. She wrote an article last year for Poetics, in which you can find all her findings. Just I go briefly to them, but for me it's again crucial, because a lot of politicians, ministers of cultures, now also in Flanders, they think that culture can bind people, that culture will bring social cohesion. I think the former Minister of Culture in the Netherlands, they have to write every year, every 5 years, such a kind of statement and plan for them, and the title of it was Culture Binds. So they really believe in this kind of idea of social cohesion. Hanka Otter analyzed what is social cohesion about, and she first of all looked at about a lot of sociologist studies about social cohesion without looking at culture. There's a lot of stuff written about social cohesion. But so for her, it refers to the cohesion among individuals and groups in society. So it's your social fabric. That's a general definition on that. But on the individual level, and you see already when you talk about concepts there, there is already often a kind of mix of and confusion also between social cohesion and social capital. So social capital comes, in fact, I know it from the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, who talked for the first time. Social capital is something else. Social capital is also social cohesion, but social cohesion in relationship to your possibility of social mobility. So also to build a career, for example, etc. So social capital has a really is in fact also a very economical term, and it is often confused. But we see we found that researchers, for example, related to social capital, that youngsters who do amateur theater, that they get more leadership roles later on. It's empirical proven. This kind of research. So it has an influence on social capital, but again, social cohesion is something else. Social cohesion then. When you look at the literature, Hanka did this for us in her PhD also, you see different dimensions of social cohesion. So we really have to know what we are talking about when we are talking about social cohesion. So first of all, she says there is a and she takes this also out of the literature, of course, there is a relational dimension. Relational dimension is what you see here. People gathering together. They have physical contact, etc. Already first mistake in policy. A lot of it was Bert Ossio, former minister of culture in Belgium. He said, oh, social cohesion, culture is very important. I organize barbecues. You can get subsidized for barbecues in the neighborhood, social cohesion. Well, the huge mistake is, of course, that the relational dimension is not related to the idealistic dimension. That means we all feel Flemish, for example, or we all feel Belgian, etc. That's the ideological dimension that you have when we are all supporting for the Belgian team, the Red Devils or something like that. That's the we all feel at that moment it's the same identity. But it's something different, and in fact, there's no causal relationship at all between relational dimension and idealistic dimension. Very interesting to know that. So, just bringing people together in festivals, etc., says nothing about this dimension of social cohesion. It's also social cohesion, but it's another dimension. So it does not mean yet that we feel together when we are brought together in a physical sense. Second thing, and this is for me very, very important, and this is for me the crucial findings of Hanka in her study, she makes a huge differentiation, again she takes it out literature, between binding social cohesion and bridging social cohesion. Binding means we come all together, we sing together, and we feel we are the same. And we share the same identity, not them. This is very important. That's what binding social cohesion does. And this is what a lot of, I have to say, art does. When art is used to bring social cohesion, it's mostly used in a binding principle. So that means also it's not bridging. And bridging means that you are open for the other, for people you don't know, people who have completely other attitudes, etc. That's bridging. And she found also in her research where art can help be helpful in bridging, but then you have to follow completely other strategies. And she exactly found this in artists who work very autonomous, so did not kind of social artistic work, but in fact they confronted people with another point of view on life, on situations, etc. And there we see not cohesion, but correlation between people who are interested in this kind of what I call dismeasurement art, which brings you something else than a measurement or what you are used to in culture, and standing open for the other. So it is, I think, very important when we say, when we're talking about methodology, for example, it's what you want. Eh? Sometimes binding is fine. Eh? It's not. I'm not against binding. Eh? That's not what I'm saying. But you really need to know what you want to do. And she analyzes this really for, she does a huge survey over 4 years with different measurement moments. Where she looks really at the networks of people, how they function, but she does also case studies, and she looks at 8, I think, or 7 case studies in which she in detail describes what is happening here in the arts and what is happening here in the arts. And it's exactly that, when you confront in an artistic project people with things they are not, they feel unstable with, they not confirm already what they know, then you have at least a chance to break in and to open people for otherness, etc. But it's a very complex thing. It's very complex. Anyway, so social effects. So this relation is also, what is all, often expected is that culture can bring social change, social innovation, etc. It's not so evident. It's not, it is, we didn't find any empirical research which proves this. But there is a strong correlation between cultural participation and social networking. I said it already, social capital with the children who do amateur theater. And cultural participation leads to both binding and bridging cohesive behavior. And I think it's very important, again, to think about which methodologies to use to go into that. Anyway, that I will only talk about this, about the social effects, and also positive, I think, social effects of arts and thing. I now try to go to the discussion we described also in this book, Community Art. You can get it for free there. In which we discovered by doing research about community art a lot of troubles, also a lot of beautiful projects, I have to say, but a lot of discussion points. It was also for me very interesting, which is just an anecdote, when I discussed with the publisher the title of the book, that at that moment, it's 2013, there was not one book which was published with the title Community Arts. Very strange for me was it. So just the blunt title, Community Art, I mean. We were searching for complex titles, etc., but this was not existing yet. And what is interesting also, that I will talk later about the reception of the book also, I think it was the first book which tries at least to connect believers and non-believers. Because what you see in a lot of books of community art and studies about it, it's all made by believers. It are people who make community art and believe in it. And it is most of the time contested by people of the so-called professional art field. The curators, the artists, autonomous artists, at least in the visual arts and museums, etc. So there is still, what we discovered with making this book, a huge gap between those two fields, what we also call, and I see it every day again in my own work field here in Belgium, there is a huge gap between the professional art field, for example, literally, and it's almost disgusting, I think, but anyway, you have organizations in Antwerp like Extra City who said, we want to have political discussions, we need to be engaged in the city, etc. And then I say, yes, but there is a very beautiful social artistic project going on called Rooftop Tiger with a thing, and oh no, that's social artistic. So you still have this kind of very strange thing. Anyway, we try to bring in this discussion in this book, and that's also why I come up with this discussion thing, because there are a kind of things, I think, which are quite problematic in community art. And next step will be I try to find solutions for that. But it's also where a lot of artists fight with, even in the community art more and more. I know a lot of artists who say, no, I don't do this anymore, this kind of community art. I just go back to make my autonomous art sometimes. Or they find other solutions because of these problems. First of all, this critique comes not from me, but from BAVO. They call themselves Independent Study Group in Belgium. They say, first of all, when you look at community art, they have a lot of problems with what we call NGO art. And what do they say about NGOs? They say an NGO can work not on the political level, only on the social level. Otherwise, they will be blocked. So it is very difficult to discuss when you go, for example, in a war zone as an NGO, you don't decide which party you take. Of course not. Otherwise, you cannot function. So they say a lot of community art is also based on this kind of principle. So you concentrate on the pragmatical. For example, you go to a suburb to work there with subaltern groups, immigrants, etc. And you try to find social solutions, methodology. You set them in and to work with them to, for example, to make a better social cohesion. I just say it blunt. So that's very much on the practical level. What we saw, and it is also noted in the book, when, for example, an artist is working for 3-4 years, when this ever happens, I come later to that, in a social artistic project in such a suburb, and he or she discovers that the problems which are, or the origin of the problems in the suburb are not only social ones, but are, for example, have to do with politics. For example, one artist we interviewed, he discovered that there was a lot of criminality in the suburb. He was asked to work there in this neighborhood. I have to say, it is what they call in the Netherlands Krachtweken, where he worked. It's a very positive way of saying that's a problematic region. Anyway, and he discovered after working a month there with the people that criminality came just from a practical thing that the public light was broken everywhere. So there was no light or light enough anymore at night in this place. And then he tried to find out how does it come that it is not solved. And then he discovered, oh, this is a this whole neighborhood, the houses are built in a kind of public-private relationship contract. So the government was saying to the private company, you have to solve this problem of the lights. And they were saying, yes, you have to solve the problem of lights. Then he started to make a political action of that. He said, okay, it has to do with politics. Then the second thing what happened to us is subsidized were finished the day after. He could stop the project. It was subsidized by the local government. So this is what you often see when you go on the political level, it's done. Yeah? And that's a huge problem, I think, things. And that means also that you see in a lot of those projects, I call it a denial of structural problems. You only can go on the pragmatical level. Second thing, comes from Herbert Marcuse, and it is related to a project of Benjamin Verdonk. I describe it also in the book. I don't know if you can call the work of Benjamin Verdonk community art. We can discuss this as something else. It's an artist based, he makes theater, but he's certainly socially engaged, and he did a specific project. I try to explain what repressive tolerance is for me, related to the work of Benjamin Verdonk. He made a project, it's called Kalender, 1 year long here in Antwerp. He did a lot of interventions in the streets. Some were very, were joking with public situations. He made also gardens, etc. He made very, absurd things. But in this project, he worked also with refugees, illegals who were here, and he did I think a beautiful project in the street with that. But for me, it's much more interesting how the project is a film about on canvas. You can that's the public broadcasting here. You can download it for free. A whole documentary. This is beautiful because I think it's in a way very honest, especially what Benjamin Verdonk himself says about this project. But what is interesting, this film starts with a meeting like here, where Benjamin Verdonk is standing here, explaining what he is going to do the next year of all provocative things in the city. And who is sitting there are a lot of people of the cultural field who support this project, of course, but also the mayor of Antwerp at that moment, not the recent mayor. It was Patrick Janssens, a socialist mayor, etc. And you see also in the documentary, very beautiful, so he's saying, yes, and we're going to do a kind of riot there, and we're going to do that there, political action, and we're going to do this with the refugees and the illegals there, etc. So he's proposing all the projects, etc. And afterwards, the mayor comes to him, you see it for the camera, says, well done, Benjamin Verdonk. Fantastic that you do all those provocative political actions in my street. This is repressive tolerance. It means really that when you have the power, you incorporate the power and say, okay, well done, I allow a little bit of provocative power structure, but at the same time, of course, you neutralize. That's what you do in this kind of situation. And that's a huge trap. There's a beautiful lecture of the mayor of Mechelen. He gave in a seminar like this here 2 years ago, and he explains this. The huge problem I have, he said, as a mayor, Bart Somers was it, who's now minister, he said, the huge problem I have to don't step in this trap, to allow people to give their vote and just use it as a kind of fantail, like carnival or something like that. Anyway, what we saw when we went on tour, or where we invited to launch the book, it's very interesting that we were invited, especially those countries where the neoliberal regimes are booming. Very interesting. So what you see, we were invited several times in the United States, certainly in the UK, but also Seoul, for example. South Korea, etc. And it is interesting that community especially is living there in regimes where there is almost no subsidizing anymore for classical arts and culture. So this is also what we saw, especially in the Netherlands, where it was a shift, I think, from a kind of welfare state policy to a neoliberal policy, that they try to replace the infrastructure of the welfare state with those projects. We see a lot of this kind of krachtwijken, neighborhoods, with subaltern people, etc. in it. And that were typical neighborhoods in which 10 years ago, I have to say now 20 years ago, there were kind of classical local welfare infrastructure. For example, local school, medicine center, small ones on the local level. And of course, because of budget cut reasons, fusions, etc., they were they disappeared out of those local communities, and they were centralized somewhere. So, but that means when you destroy a local school, you also destroy a local community. And what did they do 10 years later? Say, oh, community artists, come to help us. Come in because we have a problem here. Very cheap, only half a year project, community art project. That's already one problem. And they always bring good news when they don't go on the political level. At the end, they make a beautiful performance with the local people. Let's show the local diversity. There is more connection between it, etc. So this ad is a good news show for local media, local politicians, again. So this is a problem. And again, I make maybe a little bit a kind of blunt joke of this, but more and more community artists are struggling with this. They realize that they are used and abused in this kind of system. The last thing has to do with a lot of methodologies we discovered artists use in those places. And what was for me interesting at least was that they are often not so creative at all in using methodologies. A thing what we discovered, for example, 1,000 again times is that they said, oh, we want to bring social cohesion, that people talk in the neighborhood again with each other. So we give them cameras. They can film each other, talk each other, interview each other, etc. We start a conversation with that. There's a beautiful one artist is it's a collect art theater collective called Magda Tentatief, which is based here in Antwerp. They explain beautifully in 10 points what you never should do when you do a community art project. Never give them cameras, especially not to drug addicts, which they worked with in the center, because they sell it immediately the day when they get it. But anyway, it is a joke, of course, but it is so often used, this kind of camera stuff and coming in with the media, etc., as a kind of methodology, and they say literally it doesn't work. But what do you do when you do this? When you let people film together and after a month or a year you make a performance with it or you make an exhibition with this thing, you really show their private life in public. That's what you do. And that's what Michel Foucault already mentioned. This is what you in fact are busy with is pastoral power. What it does mean by this is, again, related to the idea of socialization. In fact, what you are doing is showing these measures, showing where people are not normal behavior, and you make of this a kind of exhibition, etc., showing it to the world, and in that way you are normalizing it. In that sense, you are organizing what Michel Foucault would call a public confession of a thing, and it works also in that sense as a confession. So what the pastor does, that's why it's called pastoral power, is at one side he is responsible for the whole community, like a state or government is responsible, but at the same time he knows, like the shepherd, every individual, the bell, right? Sheep, like that. So, and this is the double thing what also a lot of social workers are involved in, but also a lot of community art. So it's kind of combining kind of micropolitics. It's really on the individual level, etc. You can read about what in detail, how it functions, etc. But also a lot of artists we interviewed struggle with that. They say, what is the right methodology then to follow? How can we really make a change in it? So, starting with this discussion, the question comes up, what to do? And a lot of artists have this question because they're fighting and struggling with it, especially when social artistic or community art is subsidized. You always have to be responsible for, you have to legitimize yourself, what is the impact, etc. So, that was our starting question. Well, the answer is, of course, and I go more and more in detail, this is constituting what we call then commoning art. But I try to explain, first of all, what is commons about, but also, now I the first step is to look at where does it start? Where is the origin of this kind of, where can we find the origin of this commoning. It starts always in what I call, and when we talk about concepts later, I think it's quite interesting, it always starts in civil space. And what is civil space for me? Civil space is for me a space where people say, we need, for example, a school here, we build it. Under what conditions? We need it here local, we need a school, we build it. So it means literally when you do something. So it's done by people who gather to each other, say, oh, we have a problem here, we do something. And that's something different than what is, I know this distinction almost does not exist in Dutch or something like that, but it does exist in English, but there's a lot of confusion also in English about this. It's not civic. Civic for me, and I say I define civic, so it's my decision to make this distinction, as what is done by the government or regulated by the government. That means, for example, people build a school and the government says at a certain moment, well done, fantastic that you do it, we regulate it. So then it becomes for me civic. So I will never speak anymore about civil servants. It are always civic servants. There are people who have a place in the government, etc., are dealing with regulations, etc. There's nothing wrong with that, but something different, I think. So civil commoning starts always from civil position. People who do, not the government who does, people who start doing something. Civil space is also not public space. Public space means for me the place in a, like say it in ideal way, like Jürgen Habermas, for example, said, is where you can argue with each other, communicate, discuss beautiful ideas. For example, the beautiful idea of democratization of education. It's a beautiful idea. But public space is also Facebook, where you could say this or that. So you can shout in public space what you want. So public space is for me the space of words, of discourse. Sometimes very well argued discourse, but also just saying yes or no, good or bad, etc. So you can shout here what you want. Civil is, again, doing. Beautiful idea, public space. Democratization of education, civil space, okay, we need it here, we build a school. That's a huge difference. Or we need more public space, so we make a blog, we organize ourselves, and we make a newspaper, a general, etc. Civil is from me. Now I go more and more to explain what commons is. When you need both, civil and public, so you need good ideas and you need to realizing and doing, that's what I call praxis. It's a classical Marxist term, but I don't use it in the Marxist sense. It just means that you are well informed using concepts to do things. Or you try also to reflect on your doing and analyze it and give it conceptual names. That's for me the praxis. It's thinking while you're doing or doing while you're thinking. That's the main thing. So, and now it comes, where it comes commons in then? It's praxis plus the discussion about democratic access to regulation. You built your school, you have it now, but then you discover, of course, and you had your civil action, you build a civil service with your community, you build a school, and then it comes, you have only 25 seats. Who can come in and who not? So all discussions about commons are about access, access to resources. And there the whole discussion comes in, and a lot of artists are struggling with this. So commons is based on civil space. Anyway, and that's why I showed this picture. I will explain it later in a second. A lot of those things happen not official. So it means it happens really between creativity and criminality. It's not criminal when people build a school, but they don't know yet if it is accepted by the government, their actions, their undertakings or not. That's the main thing. That's why I showed this beautiful commoning art project of Recetas Urbanas. It's an activist architect group in Spain, Seville. This construction is also built in Spain. It's built there for a certain reason. It's built there because they found it that there is no regulation at all in Spain, but they even claim in Europe, which says what can happen between the leaf of a tree and the roots of a tree. So this is what they call a legal space. So it's not illegal, but it's also not legal. What is this? This is a house for the homeless. This is a shelter. So people can shelter there. And that's why they construct it there, because the police can look at it and they can do nothing. Because it's illegal, this space. It's not defined, etc. And this is, for me, the very interesting zone, I think, where commoning comes in. A lot of commoning organizations are illegal because they fell between the rules of public and private law, literally. They are not subsidized, but they are also not working on the market, so they have to invent another kind of organization. And that's where a lot of those things are invented. I know this has a huge Robin Hood idea, but it's just to illustrate where it happens, because it happens every day in our streets in Antwerp, for example, when people say, okay, we want to make a garden here, we break up the floor. It's illegal even to do that. So a lot of people who start doing this kind of alternative organization to create also art, etc., in it, come on this in this kind of gray zone between the legal and the illegal. A little bit more about in detail than what commons is about. So commons means that there is a commonwealth. This comes from Elinor Ostrom. If you are very much interested in what commons is about, then read the book Governing the Commons of Elinor Ostrom. She won the Nobel Prize for Economics with this book and her studies, of course, in 2009. Just after the financial crisis, not by accident. And she says always, when you talk about commons, you need a resource. It can be different things, but there are very old ones. Some are 1,000 years old, like fields, forests, which are used by a community of people to heat their houses, for example, etc. And they can take this resource for free. But of course, we know them also from cultural resources like language. We speak still free language for free. Codes, affects, creative ideas, social relationships, etc. So a lot of common pool resources are for free and are also immaterial. So you have material resources, immaterial resources. When you build a school, it's a material resource, of course, in it. But to talk about commons, you need also commoners. That are people who manage and try to manage this common pool resource and find a system for access, for example, but also to manage who can come in, who can use it, who not, etc. So they find rules. But in fact, commoners are every human being who shares. So for me, it's also very important to stress this related to culture. We share a lot of commons, what we don't mention as commons. When, for example, I helping my children at home with their homework, I'm a commoner. Because I don't ask money to do that. So we have not a contract relation. And also, the government, until now, does not force me to do that. So it is my own relationship with that building. So a lot of commons, what is not defined like that, but you need some principles to manage it, and that is most of the time used by radical democratic principles, cooperation, management of use of those CPRs, those common pool resources. You see here a typical democratic way of sharing a common pool resource. This is a picture of an assembly in L'Asilo, it's in Napoli, Naples, where they, in fact, this is the directing board of a huge venue, L'Asilo. It's a theater building with studios in it, etc. And this is your directing board. That means this is everybody who wants to sit there on every Friday and say, I want to have this space coming week or next month for this. And they have to discuss. Everybody can come in. That's your board who decides, the programming board. So it's a very democratic principle. There are problems also with it, which I try to come up later. But that's the main thing how it works. For me, very important, and that's the ideological side, that's also why we made the book Communism. to do this all, you need to believe in something. And then an ideology for me comes in. You need to believe very strong in social relationships and the power of social relationships. And that is, for me, a huge difference with those other ideologies, communism and neoliberalism. And we think always that they are really the opposite of each other. They are. But they share one thing. They share both that the base of society is economy. And that's the main difference. Commoners believe that the base of society are social relationships. That's a huge distinction. And more concrete, they believe that culture is the base of society. So when Marx talks about superstructure and base, he says superstructure is culture, is law, is politics, and the base is production relationships, so economy in it. Communism says a different thing. It says culture is the base. What do I mean by that? I don't say culture is a good or a bad thing. That's not about. Culture is really a toolbox you can use to signify yourself and to give meaning to your social context. When you understand culture as the base of society, that means also that you can change definitions, giving meaning to things. You can change, you can give another meaning to, for example, economical relationships. That means also that politics and economy, for example, economy as an organization, is culture. It's based on signification processes, giving meaning. When you know this, you know also, literally, that you can develop other economies. And that's the main principle, and other politics, etc. So, to go blunt in the academic way, we have to put Marx on his head. So the basis is culture and not economy, and the superstructure is also economy. But we have to also put this guy on his head, to somebody knows who this is. This guy is well known, but that one.
Keynes.
Eh?
Sorry,
Keynes.
Keynes?
No. I will stop in a second. No, in 4 minutes. It's the inventor of neoliberalism. Hayek. Somebody? Hayek. Yeah. So he also won the Nobel Prize, by the way, in the 50s. Strange, nobody knows. I have this always in situations. But this is just to say, neoliberalism is invented. It's not a system which is hanging there out there. It's really empirically developed in Chicago by economists, and it is used and tested for the first time in Chile of Pinochet, and then they try to develop all over the world. By the way, in the invasion of the United States in Iraq, a year later, economists were there to develop democracy in Iraq. That means to implement this kind of neoliberal system. I make a huge mistake here. You cannot put Hayek on his head because he is not a dialectical thinker. He doesn't think. There is only one monolithical thing, market. So you can put him not on his head. This is just an academic thing, my resources, where I get it. Maybe we can think better in this guy's words, Italians, Gramsci. This is Antonio Gramsci, and he is the first one who mentions, he says, culture, you first need a cultural revolution to have an economical and political revolution. So he at least says that culture is a very important tool. Anyway, one but last scheme, but very quick. About how I understand this whole position of the commons is, it's a third space in which we develop things. We are normally used only to think in market and state, but this is happening everywhere, and there are huge spaces already, again, existing for 1,000 years. There are examples in the Alps, for example, where people share fields for 1,000 years. They are organized, so sustainable, amazing how they do it. But it is often not recognized as a commons or even notioned as that. For me, very important, and I'll come back to the relationship or the distinction with community, which is for me very important. So commoning is about redefining and resignifying economy, social relationships. That's a cultural thing. Redefining, resignifying society in general. But, and this is for me important, beyond communities and identities. What do I mean by that? It's a huge trap of commoning artists, but it is also, it has to do with this. It means that if you want to share, for example, a school, you don't need to have the same values and norms. You don't need to have the same identity. The only thing you need to have is the interest to share the school. So this is very important, I think, when we talk about infrastructure, even sharing a country and its welfare state, its welfare, is based not anymore on identity and community, it's based on the thing you want to share. And of course, there needs to be consensus about that. But you can have completely different identities, etc. And that's, I think, the win of thinking in about commons instead of community. And I just give you one example in the music field. I thought this is my obligation, so I skip it. I just show, sorry for the bad quality picture of internet. This is Splendor. It's a music organization in Amsterdam. And what for me is interesting is how they organize, and especially related to community and identity is for me very interesting. So they claimed and get also a huge venue, an old bathhouse in the center of Amsterdam, to give performances, to do rehearsals, rehearsals, etc. There are 50 musicians together who organized it. This. They all put it 1,000 euros in a pot, and then they had an agreement with the government that they get a building when they had so much money together. It was a kind of agreement. So they get a building. That's the only thing. But for me, it's much more interesting to share with you the principle of identity, commons, community. So they are with 50, because 50 is the most they can do or get for the use of this building. It's very vivid. You can go there to beautiful experimental music performances almost every evening. It's very dynamic what's happening there. They do a lot of things what also happens then in the concert hall later on, so it's very strange what they do. But they have one principle to work together. One is, that's not a principle. That's something what I discovered. With the 50 artists, so they managed with 50 artists this thing. They never had one meeting. So they just agreed on things by internet. They never discussed anything. So they only had connections via, etc. And still until now, they had not one meeting. They are existing now 7 years, I think, and it functions fantastic. Second, but this is a principle. They said, you can come in as we only can allow 50. So when somebody is dropped out, we search for something new to come in the group because of the place is limited. But one rule, we never discuss about artistic quality. Never. The only thing what we do is that we say every body of the 50 people has the same time slot to use this building. So it's very pragmatic. So what I want to say by this, it is not about talking about identity, artistic identity, etc. Because we see, we do a lot of research on those organizations who do that. 2 years, finished, fights with each other. So it is again not about identity, it is really about finding that it is necessary to share something. That can be also sharing a social service, etc. So, yes, I think it's better to stop here because probably you will have many questions. Thank you.